This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. We begin in Lowell, where in the basement of every school building is a sort of mall.
It's like a boutique. It has every size of clothing. They're on hangers. I love going in. I love looking at it. They have toiletries. We have everything there.
That's Nancy Humphreys, who's a homeless liaison with Lowell Public Schools. And the boutiques are part of a city program called Katie's Closet. And they're just one way that the district is working to support families without housing. Right now, nearly 1,700 kids in the district fit into that category. So to put it in perspective, that means roughly 1 in 10 students. And back in 2019, that number was 1 in 20. Rebecca Duda is a district homeless liaison for the Lowell Public Schools, coordinator of the Family Resource Center, and joins us here in Studio 2. Welcome, Rebecca.
Welcome. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. So these are everyone's kids. These are anyone's kids, aren't they, Rebecca?
Oh, absolutely. These are students who are entering the public school system in Lowell.
And tell us a little bit more about these kids. I want to understand who these kids are. Tell us a little bit about a kid.
Sure. Well, the children come from very different backgrounds. Homelessness can affect any family, right? Housing insecurity is probably at one of its highest points it's been recently due to lack of, affordable housing. But the children can be, they could be low-born, and they've been evicted from their homes. They could be newcomers to the city who have arrived from Brazil, Ecuador, Colombia, or another country, and they don't speak English, and they're just trying to start a new life. They could be folks fleeing domestic violence. So each family is unique in their experiences.
When we are in the middle of a change, sometimes it's hard to see it, right? Because it happens gradually around us. When you hear that 1 in 10 number now versus 1 in 20 just 3 years ago, does that surprise you? Were you like, yeah, no, that tracks, or yes, I already knew that? Talk about that. I mean, that's a huge change in 3 years.
Sure. No, it doesn't really surprise me because we see each year the numbers are going up in housing. There's a shortage of housing, affordable housing for families and folks. And, you know, with inflation the way it is and the cost of living, it's not surprising, to me as someone who works with the families,
And what does it mean when a family doesn't have housing? I think the sort of traditional imagination of those who haven't had that experience is literally you are living on the streets. What is the actual definition of not having housing?
Sure. For in education, the definition is a little different. We fall under the McKinney-Vento Education Act.
Which is federal, right?
That is correct. It's federal statute. And the definition for McKinney-Vento is the child does not have adequate, stable housing. So the family could be living in their car. They could be living in a hotel. They could be living in a shelter. Or they could be doubled up with, another family member or friend because they're unable to live on their own.
And again, right now, that's 1,700 kids in the Lowell Public Schools, roughly.
Yeah, roughly.
Who are experiencing that. So stand by, Rebecca. I'm going to bring a second voice in here. Amanda Sullivan is the director of youth services with an organization called Community Teamwork. Her organization serves 32 communities in Massachusetts, including Lowell. Amanda, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Good morning.
So, Amanda, you are working with families who don't have housing, families with kids in the schools who don't have housing.
Yeah, our focus primarily is on youth and young adults, so individual young people. We do have programming that is supportive of young families as well, but our primary focus are the individuals or the students.
And you work with kids and young adults up to age 24, correct?
Yes, we do.
So is there a story that you can tell us of a young person, a kid, a teenager, a young adult that you're working with and what this experience means for them? Being a kid's hard in the first place, Amanda. So what does it mean to be facing this kind of instability?
Yeah, I mean, so I would say every young person that walks through our door here at Youth Services all have very different experiences. And staffing here and the community in its whole you know, as a whole, really recognizes that, you know, young people who come in and they're in need and they face all sorts of different barriers, right? So if a young person comes in, I could give you so many different stories or examples about like individual situations, but realistically what it comes down to is these young people that walk through our doors are in need of support. You know, their stories are that they want to be successful. They want to succeed. They're an active part of our community, not only Lowell, but the other regions and towns that we provide services to, active parts of the school district. You know, they all want something better for themselves.
So what do they need from you, Amanda, and from Community Teamwork, from Youth Services at Community Teamwork?
What do they need from us? So they need a variety of different things. And realistically, it comes down to whatever, you know, the specifics are that brought them through the door. We offer a variety of things. So programming that we have here ranges from young people being able to access basic needs and supportive services. So we have a day program where young people can come in, take showers if they need to, access a food pantry. They have the ability to just come into a safe environment and get, you know, hot meal, do laundry, all the way up to like long-term supportive housing. So, you know, in addition to accessing basic needs and that level of support, right, the goal really is for young people to stabilize. And so the opportunities for them to acquire housing or work on what it means to be a good tenant or develop those life skills that you need for that independent component, that's all of the things that people need when they walk through our door. And it's not necessarily immediately, right? Like someone may come in and be like, I just need a job or I need some support right now, but that graduates and that leads into like bigger and more sustainable things.
We're talking about public school kids who are who don't have housing. According to the Department of Elementary and Secondary Education, more than 18,000 kids have had that experience so far this school year. Rebecca Duda, I'll turn back to you, you know, homeless liaison in the Lowell Public Schools. I imagine kids don't want people to necessarily know that they don't have housing, that they're living in a struggling environment, and yet your job is to help kids. So talk about that.
Sure. So the role of the homeless liaison and my support staff in the Family Resource Center is to help children get into the school system, right, to register for school. And one of the things you need to provide is proof of residency, right, that where are you living? And families can't do that. So that's how we start the conversation. Tell me about your housing situation, right? Because I see you can't provide a lease or, you know, a mortgage or some other utility bill.
So that's like a cue.
And that's the cue, yeah. So that's when we start having that conversation. And that's the key term. It's a conversation. Talk to me about, you know, your living arrangements. And then we do an assessment based on what they say. And to follow up with my colleague from CTI, our goal is to provide stability because a lot of these families are very unstable in their housing and they may be transient. And housing insecurity, you know, causes instability, but we want the child to be stable in their school experience. So we get them into school as quickly as possible, get them settled if they need, you know, some basic supplies, you know, clothing, things like that, because we have access to Katie's Closet that you referenced at the beginning of the show. But families can be hesitant, you know. They may not feel that they are homeless because, you know, they might be doubled up with another family member. But our role is to provide that support to get the child into school and provide some stability.
So I'm going to stay with you on that for a minute, Rebecca. A few weeks ago when we were having conversations with organizations on the ground that were supporting families, there were a series of stories, Methuen, Kingston, Plymouth, where families were moved into hotels or motels there as part of the state's response to homelessness for families with kids under 21 or pregnant people. The communities didn't necessarily know they were coming, or the cities didn't, and there was a lot of uproar around that. And one of the things that came up at that time was kids in families that don't have houses can get moved around. And yet the stability of staying in a school district, staying in a school for a kid is important. So as you're working, are you struggling with that? And how do you help a family ensure that if their kids now get registered in the Lowell Public Schools, that they can stay? You talked about the stable environment.
Correct.
What's the challenge there, and how do you work with that?
All right. So once you enroll with us and we've identified you as falling under McKinney-Vento, we would be considered the school of origin, right? So you're entitled to remain in your school of origin, you know, until if you're in kindergarten through grade four, and then if you need to go on to the middle school, the feeder pattern. So if the family should move to another community, you know, say they were in shelter in Lowell, and then they got moved to a shelter in another community, we would set up transportation for that child. And the family actually has a choice. They could enroll in their new community if they thought it was in their best interest. Because, again, we work together. It's a partnership with the school district, you know, the school and the family. But most families would prefer to have the child remain in their school of origin because they know the teachers, they've built relationships.
Because anyone would.
Exactly.
Right.
Right. It's your school community, right? So we set up transportation through different vendors.
And most of the time you can do that successfully. The kid is moved someplace that is close enough and the transportation is doable enough that if the family wants the kid to stay in the school of origin most of the time, can they?
Yes, yeah, and that's the goal. It may take a little bit to set up the transportation, but we work to provide that stability to the family.
So turning back to you, Amanda Sullivan, you know, Youth Services at Community Teamwork, I really want to dive a little more into this idea of stability. Mm-hmm. Anyone who remembers their childhood, anybody who has a child, knows the anxieties of a changing world around a kid. Creating that sense of security, consistency, stability. You're working with some really vulnerable kids under, you know, age 24 and younger. What are other things communities can do to provide that sense of stability for kids who may not have a home?
Wow, that's a really great question. I mean, I think that when it comes to stability, right, I think it comes with opportunity. Recognizing that young people who may be struggling with housing instability across the board present in very different ways. And some young people may not even recognize as being housing insecure, right, if they're couch surfing or bouncing around. Some of the perception is that as long as there's a roof over their head, right, they're safe and they're secure. But in fact, you know, that kind of leads to other barriers that that young person might face throughout, you know, the course of their lives or their adulthood. You know, I think from a community perspective, it's just recognizing and being mindful of the fact that, you know, young people experiencing housing instability exists, and acknowledging that and advocating that there is more opportunity for stable housing and resources and access to mental health services or substance use programs or all of those other things that really kind of help guide and support young people on their journey. You know, we at Youth Services here and you know, across Lowell and the communities, we do a lot of advocating to make sure that people, you know, that it is, that is a situation, and there's, you know, conversations that are happening at a higher level. Just a quick plug here. November is Homeless Youth Awareness Month. And so that's been something that for the past month or so, well, I guess a couple weeks, we've been really trying to make sure people are aware and they know that homelessness and housing insecurity isn't just families, right? That's a huge part of it, or individuals or adults, but that there's this demographic that's right in the middle that needs their attention and to be prioritized. Go ahead.
Well, so Amanda, one of the things that strikes me about this, you know, you are with a nonprofit organization with target population, and you're doing that work with nonprofit resources to do so. Rebecca Duda here in Studio 2, Lowell Public Schools, a municipal school district. A lot of the policy, the resources and stuff happen at the state level, too. And we've got a colleague here at WBUR, Gabriella Emanuel, who's currently reporting on a story about the state's shelter hotline and how families are having trouble accessing support through it. So where can families and kids, how do they get started in finding support? Step one, I need help. What's step one that is accessible and they can take?
Is that a question
for you, Amanda? Yep, for you.
For me, that's for me. Well, there's a variety of different ways. I mean, there's a lot of local resources. Realistically, when it comes down to, there's information about being able to connect to emergency services and state-funded programs, you know, all over the internet. I don't necessarily know if there's one specific place that I would send. One thing I do want to acknowledge, though, for young people in itself is the system is a little bit different in regards to accessing supportive services and shelter and emergency resources in that lens as well.
What do you mean by that?
I mean that for young adults, so the population that we particularly work with, right, young adults may not necessarily have the opportunity to go through state kind of facilitated shelters or emergency shelters. There's different programming that exists across the state that's specifically geared towards young people, 18 plus, and even as low as 16, that would provide emergency supportive services, shelter, but then also opportunities for pathways to like longer term housing options. So I think right now there's a lot of there's different opportunities, right? But there's really kind of a lot of effort trying to figure out the logistics of the differences between family, adults, and young people accessing housing supports. So
thanks for that. And Rebecca, you know, last couple sentences to you. What keeps you in the work as a homeless liaison for kids?
Oh, well, it's very rewarding work serving, you know, our youth and our families, right? And seeing them along their journey. That's what one of my colleagues, Nancy Humphrey, likes to call it, their journey, right? Because one of the things we do is we work with the folks over at Community Teamwork. And it's not just getting the child into school. It may be helping them to connect with the shelter system, right? Other resources in the community. And there's nothing like helping a family try to find, housing security along the way and help the youngster stay in school and be successful.
All right. Rebecca Duda is coordinator of the Family Resource Center and District Homeless Liaison in the Lowell Public Schools. And Amanda Sullivan is the director of youth services with an organization called Community Teamwork. Rebecca, Amanda, thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Just last week, Harvard's Peabody Museum announced that it was going to return pieces of hair taken from some 700 Native American children from about 300 tribal nations who had attended boarding schools run by the U.S. government. That was just a few days after the Barry Museum Association returned moccasins, pipes, and other artifacts to representatives of Lakota tribes, though, as you will hear, artifact might not be the right word. Museums here in Massachusetts and across the country are reevaluating how they curate Native American artwork. We recently sat down with two local curators of Native American art to talk about it. Marina Tykenko is inaugural Ellen McColgan Assistant Curator of Native American Art at the Museum of Fine Arts, and Tess Lukey is the inaugural Associate Curator of Native American Art at the Trustees of Reservations. And I started by asking Tess to tell us about a piece of Native American art that speaks to her.
Actually, I'm wearing like an incredible pair of earrings today that have been my favorite now and feel very much me and me in the future. I think they're made by an artist named Alicia Marie, and she's a Passamaquoddy artist, and she incorporates really amazing big earrings, traditional works, and traditional materials into her work, such as sweetgrass. And I find that really, really fantastic because it touches on her traditions, my traditions as a Native community member, but also kind of on contemporary Native culture.
They're big discs, maybe a couple of inches, a beautiful pattern in the middle and several layers around the outside of beading and sort of like jewelry style work. Is that a fair description?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the most interesting piece of these today actually is there is a braid of sweetgrass around the outside and in the middle, a really important material and plant to Native peoples.
So Marina, how about you?
Well, half a day to all my tomorrow folks. And thank you so much for that question. Since I'm at the MFA now, I'm going to just speak about a piece that I'm very excited about that's been on view since about March, which is a 6-photograph series called Hannah DeGaia's Town Destroyer by Alan Michelson, who is a Mohawk artist who actually grew up in Boston and is now based in New York. And it tells the story through projections of images on a bust of George Washington of the Clinton-Sullivan Expedition, which was a kind of genocidal campaign ordered by George Washington. And it allows us to present George Washington's history of treatment of Native Americans. It's surprising, it's beautiful, and also it connects us with someone who grew up in Boston and feels very connected to the local Boston community.
Is that a contemporary artist?
It's a contemporary artist, yes. So that is a piece from 2022, and it's currently on view in our Revolutionary War Gallery. It's the first contemporary work we've had on the walls since we opened the wing in 2010.
So what is the work today, Tess. So you are the inaugural associate curator of Native American art at the Trustees of Reservations. It is of note that they created this role now. What is the work that is now before trustees, museums, that should have been the work all the time, but that we're recognizing and embracing now?
Well, I think that we're at a really important time where Native culture is very much a part of today. You know, there's no more denying that Native people live in the past. There's no more denying that that culture is dead, that our people are still here. And so to be the inaugural curator in Massachusetts, being a Native from the area, I'm a Quinnawampanoag, it's really incredible to be working to bring us more to the forefront of conversation in museums and make us incredibly visible. I mean, pieces like what Marina has introduced in their Revolutionary Gallery and pieces like Counterculture, which we have out in Western Mass for the trustees, bring us really visibly to the public. And being able to be someone from New England, from a Native community, working in that way, it's an honor, and I'm really excited to see what the future holds.
Marina, what did it take to get us here? I mean, the MFA has been on its own journey in terms of reckoning not only with its relationship with the Black community and with Black art, but also Native art for a while now. Some would sort of see the sculpture, The Appeal to the Great Spirit, that's out front, which was by a white artist for a white audience, but was meant to depict that perception of a Native American, as something that the MFA has moved past in the last few years, in terms of bringing forward all the art in the basement, building the garden around that statue, bringing new curators in. What is the journey that we're on in terms of our relationship, both as curators of Native American art and as people who are being exposed to it, really in some cases for the first time?
Yeah, that's such a great question. I am the inaugural assistant curator of Native American art, but Native American art has been collected by the MFA since 1877. The first curator actually acquired several works of the mostly Zuni pottery from the 19th century. And so this area of the collection, Native American art, has been something that the MFA has always viewed as art and always wanted to collect but did not have a dedicated curator for. And several curators at the institution in my lifetime and before have really recognize the importance of living artists, especially. So the work that I'm able to do now, and I love that you mentioned the garden project. Garden for Boston is something that actually Tess and I both worked on together, which was a very special and important piece that recognized Equa Holmes, who is a fabulous Roxbury Native, and also Elizabeth James Perry, who is a Quinnawampanoag from Tess's community and also her relation. And it's really exciting that we're at a place now where I can build upon the work, build upon the collection that has needed care for a long time and also had many different champions of it, including Tess when she was in the Art of the Americas department. So although I'm the first person to hold the title of Assistant Curator of Native American Art, there have been several colleagues who considered this area of the collection important. I think, as Tess said so beautifully, it's kind of impossible to ignore Native Americans in this moment. I don't think it's particularly, it should never have been easy to, but I think as institutions are reckoning with a lot of their past, they also need to think about where they are, the land that they sit on, and the communities that have shepherded that land, that have stewarded that land since time immemorial.
We're speaking with Marina Tykenko, who is the inaugural Ellen McColgan Assistant Curator of Native American Art at the MFA, and also with us Tess Lukey, who's the inaugural Associate Curator of Native American Art at the Trustees of Reservations. One of the things that struck me, Tess, as I asked you and Marina at the beginning about pieces of art that stood out to you, you both talked about contemporary art. Tess, you're wearing some contemporary art today. One of the things in preparing for this and hearing some of the wisdom from the two of you that our producer, Sydney Bowles, got before we started talking to each other was this idea that there's art that people make as art that you're supposed to view and experience as art. And then there are, my words, artifacts, Tess, which are artistically and gorgeously made, but at one point were items for use. And how does one—I had never really thought about it that way before. How do you think about both of those sets of curation, especially because some of that was somebody else's, not meant to be in a museum, but meant for a purpose?
So most of my expertise, though I do have expertise in contemporary art, a lot of the stuff that I choose to focus on as a curator, but also as a community member, is a lot of those historic things that you would have called artifact. But, you know, I honestly kind of dislike that word because it is so entrenched in the past. And a really interesting thing that I think about when thinking about historic collections kind of in a contemporary moment is the language that we use to describe them. In the Wampanoag language, there's no word for art.
Interesting.
And I think that that's a really incredible concept to bring into this field as a curator, because art is inherently a part of everything. And so those objects, though they may not be meant to be displayed in a museum, they're still works of art. They're still a part of our everyday lives. That's why when you asked me that question about, you know, what's a favorite piece of work that you're thinking about right now, it's the earrings I'm wearing today, because that's the most recent piece of art, piece of my everyday life that makes me excited and happy and brings a smile to my face and makes me think about my community members and the place I'm located. It has all of this underneath it, these layers underneath it that you have to kind of bring forward when you're talking about the contemporary moment and Native people and Native art in that time. And so bringing those historic objects in conversation with more contemporary works is, I think, the future here in museums.
So help me do better,
yeah.
Tess. If I want to use the word artifact in the future, and that's not the right word, give me some other language that I can use, that listeners can use, as we begin to think differently.
Well, I think that the biggest thing and most important thing, rather than referring really generally to pieces, be more specific. Specificity is the key. If you're looking at a piece of art and it's from a specific community, reference that specific community. Don't just say it's Native art, say it's Passamaquoddy art, like my earrings. It's important to give those communities their time and recognize that it's not just something that's general. It's not something that in the past would have been considered pan-Indian or pan-Native. Specificity is always best.
Thank you for that. So, Marina, let me turn to you. One of the things that I think about in imagining your work, which is very hard for me to imagine, I've never done anything like that before, but trying to imagine your work at the MFA, is the scope and the range of the types of pieces that are available to make something that tells a story to people.
I just want to also offer something in addition to the artifact question, which
is
the term belongings, which then gives a sense of personhood to a lot of objects as well, and also allows us to see many things that people have made as a little bit more connected to the people.
So belongings is a word that you would recommend using.
I would recommend using it. I don't know. I'm sure Tess can offer some thoughts, but it's one that I've kind of brought more into my vocabulary to give a greater sense of, I think personhood is really the best way to say it.
Agency, definitely.
Agency.
Yeah.
Thank you, Tess. Okay, so do you mind just repeating your question?
Yeah, it was a long and convoluted one, so I'll give you a little bit better second version since I get a chance to do it again. When you curate, mm-hmm. in a space like the MFA, with the size, the scope, the range of the art that's there, the belongings that are there, how do you put pieces together in this moment, in this contemporary moment around Native art, Native American art, to tell a story? And what is the work? I can't even imagine the work that goes into thinking about that and how you put that stuff together.
The way that I approach the collection and approach the work that I do now is really thinking about what are the community voices that I can listen to, that I can learn from. So even if that's something like just making sure that a lot of the sources that I'm reading about Diné or Navajo weavings are Native folks, right? So that's something that's really easy to do. So just in the research element, there's a way to really make sure that Indigenous voices are coming out, and that's who I'm listening to. And then thinking about just nuance or elaborating nuance, because things are not so black and white, right? Objects can be made that have resonances, spiritual resonances. They can be made for livelihood. They can tell important community stories, and they can do all these things at the same time. That's really difficult to communicate to the public, but I think it's, Tess is nodding, it's a big hurdle that we have to get over, and we have to really make sure that when we are sharing these stories, we're not just telling the same perspective that has been offered upon them.
Can you give an example of something that you've, an item that's been on exhibit that has that kind of nuance?
Sure. So Tess also kind of worked on this idea in the little bit of the Southwest Gallery, which is a table of blackware pottery from San Ildefonso and Santa Clara Pueblos, and thinking about this work of this super famous San Ildefonso potter named Maria Martinez, who's typically really talked about as the kind of like key figure. But actually she was a key figure, but she was part of a community. She taught her community the technology that she learned, which was to make this black on black ware. And in it, she also was able to share stories of her community, particularly the kind of like water serpent was an imagery that came up a lot. And so it was also a collaboration with her husband, as men typically were the ones who painted on pottery, while women were the potters. So in 150 words, it's difficult to kind of get all those stories across. But without them, and without even, you know, mentioning the impetus, which was a collaboration with an anthropologist, all of these stories can kind of come out of one object, and it's making sure that the perspectives that are kind of key are those Indigenous voices and community perspectives on objects.
Tess, what's the vision? What's the dream?
The dream? Oh, my goodness. That's a big question. I think for me is really, as a curator, as a community member, as a museum attendee, as, you know, a lifelong New Englander, I want to see my culture be more at the forefront of things, to not be forgotten, to be a part of every conversation. You know, when you travel down a road in Massachusetts, I want you to realize that you're on someone else's land. I want you to know that you're either in Nipmuc territory, you're in Wampanoag territory, you're in historic Penacook territory, you're in Mohican territory. There are all of these communities that still historically and still today are present. And to see that reflected in institutions, to see that reflected in public school education, to see that reflected in the land, that's the dream.
Tess Lukey is inaugural associate curator of Native American art at the Trustees of Reservations, and Marina Tykenko is inaugural Ellen McColgan assistant curator of Native American art at the Museum of Fine Arts. I want to thank you both for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sejus Maase.
Kadapitash.
I used to make fun of my pop's afro. I remember the way he trimmed it in the bathroom mirror, the way he styled and shaped it to geometric perfection. I didn't know it at the time, but I envied that hair. I still do.
That's John Vercher reading his 2017 Cognoscenti piece, The Unbearable Whiteness of Being. Cognoscenti, WBUR's Ideas and Opinions page, turns 10 this year. And to celebrate, we've been speaking with past contributors. We heard from writer Joanna Weiss and her local mom rock band, the Lazy Susans. And we spoke with Wellesley College professor Kelly Carter Jackson, who wrote about her grandmother. Today, in the last of our series, John Vercher joins us here in Studio 2. John, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
Tell me about your dad.
Oh, my dad's... He's an interesting guy. We have sort of that typical strained but not strained father-son relationship. We're not the huggers. We don't overly emote, but there's this sort of unspoken bond between us. And a lot of that has to do with how he raised me very early on to be aware and proud of my blackness, having conversations with me about that when I was as early as 7 years old.
In your piece, you start with your dad, mm-hmm. but just as you did just here, it's kind of an entree into an exploration for you of your identity, the identity he taught you, mm-hmm. The identity you're thinking about teaching your own kids. Talk about that identity some.
It's hard to talk about because it's something I'm still figuring out, honestly, even at 47 years of age. I actually think that I've spent maybe the last 10 years exploring it more than I ever did as a younger man. And a big part of that is having children now. You know, I'm the product of a mixed race relationship, and I'm in a mixed race relationship. And so I have to think in even more different ways about how do I raise my sons in the culture to be proud of their culture when they don't outwardly reflect the culture. So it's been something that I explore through my own writing and explore through conversations with family. And I think it's kind of a never-ending conversation.
When you wrote this piece in 2017, we were partway through an emerging American experience confronting our racial history.
Mm-hmm.
Partway through, but certainly not at that 2020 mark,
right,
when it feels like things erupted in a whole new way.
Right.
When you look at that piece now and you're hearing it again, and, you know, when we did the 10th anniversary celebration at City Space, you were there, I was there, you read it out loud. Does it feel like past or does it feel like present? Would you write it the same way now?
No, I don't know that I'd write it the same way. Part of that is just being a writer and looking back on old work and going, oh, that's terrible. I could have done so much better.
But it was good.
Well, thank you. But I think over the last few years, as I learn more about myself and about my own history and the history of Black culture, and speaking more with my father, especially when 2020 erupted the way that it did, I think I've added more nuance to the ideas of identity and have a different understanding of it. So does it feel old? It feels maybe slightly dated, but in very minor ways.
What does it mean to you to be biracial, to be multiracial?
I have no idea. I'm still figuring that out, honestly. It's because it's, in some ways, it is its own identity. But there is also this struggle, both internal and external at times, to choose a path and walk down that path. So, and it feels like no answer is the right answer. So I can't honestly answer that question because I think I'm still trying to figure that out.
Do you think you ever will?
I don't know. I don't know that either. I think part of the problem that one of the many problems that we deal with when it comes to this is that we're always looking to define things. We're always looking to make things so binary, right? It has to either be this or that. And I think if you figure it out, you're sort of playing into that system. And so it's far more interesting to me to explore it and ask questions about what it means than to firmly define what it means.
So I do want to talk about your voice for just a minute that in the piece you talk about the conscientious way, for example, that you and your wife curated books, children's books, you know, by people of color, about people of color. You wrote a really fascinating piece about Black characters in comic books and Marvel stories. And this was, I can't remember if it was right before the first Black Panther movie came out.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah. So what do you want your boys to know and believe about their identity, given that you don't want to buy into these strict binary kinds of categories?
I think the thing that stands out most for me, and it was a lesson that I had to learn not that long ago either, was that when I want them to celebrate their culture and want them to know who their grandfather is, who I am, that it doesn't just have to be about trauma, that it can be about the celebration of Black culture. It can be about all the successes and all the things that we've accomplished, not just the things we've suffered. You know, even as a young adult, I used to think that had to be the way that I define my Blackness, that if I suffered enough, if I had gone through the things that my father had gone through, then maybe I was Black enough. And it took an interview with another Black woman who said, you know, why do you focus so much on the trauma? And I couldn't answer the question. It hit me like a shot to the gut. I was like, you're absolutely right. So I think that's the big thing, you know, behind that piece about not being sidekicks or you know, comic book characters, Black comic book characters not being sidekicks. I want them to know that their culture isn't just about trauma. It's about celebrating successes.
Are we getting better at that?
We as in me?
No. We as in the American culture and community.
No, I don't. I think there's more. I think there's an increased consciousness about it, but I don't know that we're getting any better at it.
So you were talking about no longer wanting to focus or center trauma,
mm-hmm.
right? And as you were thinking that, I was thinking, I want to talk to him about choosing to be an MMA fighter. And then you actually referred to being called out for that or asked about that as a blow to the gut, which
right.
you know what that feels like.
Yeah, yeah.
So it is a little ironic to have a guy who says, I don't want to focus on trauma, then say, but the next thing I went to and did, in addition to being a writer, which, as I understand it, you became after starting to work on cognoscenti pieces.
Correct, yeah.
You decided to go be an MMA fighter.
Well, so I always give the disclaimer that I was sort of a tourist in MMA fighting. I trained in it and got the bug and wanted to compete, mostly to prove some things to myself. I certainly appreciate the irony, but it comes from a long history of martial arts for me. I started as a kid. I was, I watched Kung Fu Theater every Saturday, and then I was in the Taekwondo schools the minute the Karate Kid came out. But I discovered through talking about this most recent book that I wrote about MMA that the reason I loved martial arts so much is because as a mixed race kid who was trying to navigate and find who he was, I didn't have to think about that on the mat. Like, that was never a thought. That place felt like an escape for me. And then I just happened to be kind of not terrible at it. And so it was, not only was it enjoyable, but it was just sort of this one place where I could kind of let my mind go free.
So we're speaking with John Vercher. His most recent book is After the Lights Go Out, which is about an MMA fighter whose lights are kind of starting to go out a mm-hmm. little bit. And this is the last of our series speaking with WBUR Cognoscenti contributors in the 10th anniversary. You talk about it as an enjoyable experience. A lot of people spend their whole lives trying not to get hit. In fact, I think most people do, and most parents try to tell their kids not to get hit.
Yeah.
So where is the joy? I really do want to understand the joy in that, because I guess I can imagine that sense of knowing what you can take.
Yeah.
And feeling power.
Yeah.
Is that what it is?
That was a big part of it. I wrote an essay many years ago sort of comparing my journey mostly through high school, because that's where I think I felt that identity struggle the most. And being in that first and only MMA fight that I did as an amateur, there were a lot of parallels to that, because I felt in a lot of ways, not physically defenseless, but sort of mentally defenseless as a kid in high school, trying again to find where I belong, to try and find that path. And stepping into the cage or the ring, it's empowering. Like, it's terrifying. I mean, when you talk about not wanting to get hit, yeah, it's probably to this day the scariest thing I've ever done. But there is this sense that, okay, this is something I can do. I'm going to be able to walk out of here, hold my head high no matter what the outcome. Shows me that I can, as you said, I can take it.
How'd your dad feel about it?
He thought it was pretty cool. Yeah, he was. He didn't make that fight. Neither of my parents made that fight. It was pretty far away, but they were there for one of my kickboxing fights, one that I lost. And the support that I got from him, that quiet sort of just head nod and understand that I had made the effort, was pretty amazing.
And did that turn out to be important to you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure.
How come?
Sports was one of the ways my dad and I connected. It was, you know, it was the he's one of these guys that had all those old VHS tapes of NFL's greatest running backs. And, you know, boxing was part of the DNA of our house. I watched all the Hagler and Leonard fights and Ali and all that kind of stuff. So while we didn't always connect on everything, sports was that one thing. So to have him there for that was pretty, pretty amazing.
And do you connect with your kids on that?
Trying to, yeah. My kids, unfortunately, they've followed more of my other habits with video games. So it's, you know, they've recently taken to basketball, but it's always a struggle to pull them away from that iPad. But it's hard for me to criticize because I play video games myself. So
So I want to talk about writing now, because you've really painted for us here, John, a really interesting picture of your arc. This is a self-discovery arc. Mm-hmm. This is a wrestling with who you were and weren't as a kid, what you did and didn't want to be as a kid, and this journey of discovery. Where does writing fit in all of this for you? What the first time you wrote a piece and submitted it to Cognoscenti, like, how did you even get there?
Ironically, from another Cognoscenti writer, Ted Flanagan, who was at the 10th anniversary celebration with us. He and I attended the same MFA program, and we were looking to submit writing for publication to see, you know, just to, as part of exercising our craft. And he mentioned that he had gotten a piece with this thoughts and opinion page, and it's still one of my favorite things that he's ever written.
Is this the one about the boys that went to the World Series tournament and lost every game and still
so
won?
So great, so great. And getting to hear him read it again was such a cool experience. But he thought some of the personal essay writing I had done would be a fit here. And, you know, we were both trying to sell our book, and I submitted a piece, ironically, about my son, and kind of took off from there.
So that book, Three Fifths, published in 2019, was called one of the best books of the year by the Chicago Tribune. So you had a lot of success with that first book.
Yeah.
What do you love about this book, After the Lights Go Out?
It let me know that I could do it again, honestly. I was lucky enough that my first book was the thesis that I wrote for my MFA. So there was a lot of discipline involved in that, right? I had excerpts that were due to my mentors so every so often. So I had to sit down and write. This second book, there was no guarantee I was going to sell a second book, and I didn't have to have parts of it turned in to anybody to review. So one of the favorite things about that, or one of my favorite things about that book, is just that I wrote it and that I was able to sell another one, to be honest with you. But it's also about so many things that are important to me. It's about race. It's about family. MMA is really just the environment that the characters live in. So getting to write about the things that I love is always, I feel very fortunate to do it.
On your journey, what's the best of who you are right now?
I'm not sure what you mean by that.
So what do you feel best about who you are right now?
I think that I'm being the father that I'd hoped I would be, that I'm being the writing professional that I'd hoped I would be, and that I'm being the husband that I hoped I would be. That sounds really cliche and corny, but we're kind of a cliche and corny family. Like we're kind of sappy, and you know, that's how we are. And so to be successful in all those things is a pretty incredible feeling.
John Vercher is a contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti. He's a writer. His latest book is After the Lights Go Out. And you can find his Cognoscenti essays at WBUR.org. John, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's great to have you. And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Chris Siderick, Amanda Beeland, and Sydney Bowles, with Bart Tachi and Andrea Perdomo-Hernandez. Marquise Neal is our senior technical director. Titus Folladoon is our executive producer. I'm Tiziana Deering. So glad you joined us today. Tune in again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.